for pests, and some have found better ways to coexist with nature while raising produce. One way is to fight bugs with bugs. A young entrepreneur is marketing his bugs to farmers to reduce pesticide use.
This product is in fact a bunch of tiny insects that are natural predators of certain farm pests that are usually controlled with insecticides. The developers say these creatures only live for a few days, so they don't pose a threat to the natural ecosystem of farms.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition. I'm Samson Sees. See you soon.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the United States, the breadth, speed, and seriousness of the criminal investigation into election meddling by former President Donald Trump and his associates in Georgia were underscored on Friday, 15th of July, by the revelation that two pro-Trump state senators and the chair of the state Republican Party were sent letters by an Atlanta prosecutor informing them they could be indicted, according to a person familiar with the inquiry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Richard Fawcett and Danny Hakim. The piece is titled, "Prosecutor Warns Georgia Officials They May Face Charges in Trump Inquiry." In the U.S., the breadth, speed, and seriousness of the criminal investigation into election meddling by former President Donald J. Trump and his associates in Georgia were underscored on Friday, 15th of July, by the revelation that two pro-Trump state senators and the chair of the Republican Party in Georgia were sent letters by an Atlanta prosecutor informing them they could be indicted, according to a person familiar with the inquiry. The Fulton County prosecutor in Georgia, Fannie Willis, is also weighing whether to subpoena Donald Trump himself and seek his testimony before a grand jury, just days after she subpoenaed seven of Trump's advisers, including Rudolph Giuliani and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, in an investigation into efforts to overturn Donald Trump's 2020 election loss in Georgia. The special grand jury is looking into a range of potentially criminal acts, including the selection of a state of pro-Trump electors in the weeks after the election and Donald Trump's now famous call to Brad Raffensperger, the Georgia Secretary of State, asking him to find nearly 12,000 votes that would reverse his loss in that state. The letters to David Schaefer, the Georgia Republican Party chair, and state senators Burt Jones and Brandon Beach were first reported by Yahoo News. Neither the men nor their lawyers could be reached for comment on Friday, 15th of July. The potential exposure of the Republican officials could have serious ramifications in Georgia's November elections, where Burt Jones is the Republican nominee for lieutenant governor. On Friday, his Democratic opponent, Charlie Bailey, released a statement accusing Mr. Jones of being anti-American and unpatriotic for taking part in a failed attempted overthrow of the American government. David Schaefer's fealty to Donald Trump and his baseless claims of a stolen election have put him at odds with Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, a Republican, as well as Brad Raffensperger, creating an unusual schism within the state Republican Party. Both Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger easily defeated Trump-backed primary challengers this year. The so-called target letters are the latest indication that the Georgia investigation could be one of the most perilous legal problems for Donald Trump and some of his allies. The televised congressional hearings into the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol by Mr. Trump's supporters have captured the attention of many Americans, but it is unclear if they will result in charges from the Justice Department. And a high-profile investigation by the Office of the Manhattan District Attorney into allegations that Donald Trump inflated the value of his assets fell apart this year. Some legal observers have argued that Donald Trump's actions, including his post-election phone calls to Georgia officials like Brad Raffensperger, put him at risk of being indicted on charges of violating relatively straightforward Georgia criminal statutes, including criminal solicitation to commit election fraud. Fannie Willis, in court filings, has indicated that a number of other charges are possible, including racketeering and conspiracy, which could take in a broad roster of pro-Trump associates both inside and outside of Georgia. I do believe that the great likelihood is that he's heading towards an indictment, said Norman Eisen, who served as a special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during the first Trump impeachment, and who co-wrote a lengthy examination of the Georgia case by the Brookings Institution. Among other things, he said, there is powerful proof of violations of Georgia law in the form of the smoking gun tape of him demanding 11,780 votes, when it is perfectly clear from that tape that he knows those votes do not exist. David Schaefer and Burt Jones were among the 16 alternate pro-Trump electors in Georgia. The state's official electors cast their votes in the Electoral College for Joseph R. Biden Jr. Brandon Beecher's name was mentioned in an email that a Georgia Trump campaign official sent to the pro-Trump electors on 13th of December 2020, the day before the electors met at the Georgia State Capitol. That email, which was described in articles by the Washington Post and CNN last month, instructed them to meet with complete secrecy and discretion and advised them to tell Capitol security personnel that they were attending a meeting with Brandon Beach and Beth Jones. Robert Driscoll, a lawyer for David Schaefer, has argued that there was nothing secret or surreptitious about the meeting of the pro-Trump electors. Robert Driscoll noted that David Schaefer had filed a lawsuit challenging the Georgia election results that had not been ruled upon by 14th of December, the date that presidential electors must cast their votes. The alternate pro-Trump electors were convened for the sole purpose of preserving a remedy in the event the lawsuit succeeded, Mr. Driscoll said in a statement. But Fannie Willis's office in recent subpoenas to potential witnesses in the case has characterized the pro-Trump electors as being part of a multi-state coordinated plan by the Trump campaign to influence the results of the November 2020 presidential election in Georgia and elsewhere. On Wednesday, an independent journalist, George Chidi, testified before the grand jury in downtown Atlanta. Mr. Chidi said in an interview on Friday, George Chidi has previously written about finding the group of pro-Trump electors in a room in the state capitol on 14th of December 2020 and asking a woman in the room what the meeting was about. Education, the woman replied. George Chidi said he was then quickly ushered out of the room and a person was placed by the door to guard it. On Friday, 15th of July, lawyers for Bert Jones, the state senator and Republican nominee for lieutenant governor, filed a motion arguing that Fannie Willis, the district attorney, and her office should be disqualified from any investigation of Bert Jones because she had donated money and participated in a fundraising event for Mr. Bailey, the Democratic lieutenant governor candidate. Jeff DeSantis, a deputy district attorney who serves as a spokesman for Fannie Willis's office, said in a statement that the motion was without merit. Political campaign issues, Mr. DeSantis said, have nothing to do with Fannie Willis's fulfillment of her oath of office to investigate and prosecute crimes occurring in Fulton County, Georgia.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Now we find that Imam Musa al-Kadhim's life, in all of its various dimensions, is distinguished in a few things. First of all, he is distinguished in the firmness and the strength for which he stood up for when it came to the right, to truth, to haq. We also find his steadfastness in front of all kinds of events, trials and tribulations, good or bad. And we also see Imam Musa al-Kadhim's luminous behavior, his actions, his morals, and his ethics, of which no deviation or crookedness has ever been reported. And finally, the life of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam is marked by balance. It is in harmony with that of the life of the Prophet Muhammad. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن أصبركم على البلاء لأزهدكم في الدنيا.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, "Verily, he who is most preserving in the face of adversity is the most abstemious from among you."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we're talking about the beautiful dialogues of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Holy Prophet, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, we find that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam talked about affection and being considerate and kind to people. It is interesting, we find that the infallible and immaculate Imams, they really spoke about everything that you could imagine, whether it was the regular sciences or whether it was the spiritual sciences or religious sciences such as fiqh and jurisprudence and political, cultural, societal, individual matters. It is very amazing to see how these individuals and these Imams, of course, whose source of knowledge is the Almighty Allah, have such a vast array of knowledge and wisdom. It's really amazing and mind-boggling. And here, in response to showing affection and kindness towards people, when Imam al-Kadhim was talking with his companion, we find that Imam al-Kadhim says to him, showing affection to people is half of intellect. Now, of course, here, you know, we might think that intellect, aql, rationality or logic or this kind of computerized decision-making process, but this intellect, half of it is being kind and showing affection and being considerate to people. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam here in this conversation with his companion is really telling us that if you are a person who has a high level of intellect, a person who has a high level of rationality and logic, if we want to call aql that as well, but an individual who has intelligence and who has this, again, high level of intellect, then the proof that they have a high level of intellect is that they show affection and they are considerate and they are kind towards people. It's interesting. In this very materialistic and temporal way of thinking that some of us are afflicted with, we think that a high level of intellect means, you know, I don't know, like they're a doctor or an engineer or they're some kind of savvy politician or they can solve the problems of the world. Perhaps this is the other half of intellect, but at least one half of intellect in reality, as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says, is showing affection to people. So if we have an individual who we believe or we imagine has a high level of intellect, but they do not show affection to people, then truly this means that they don't have half of their intellect. They are something else. They're not an intellectual. And what a beautiful way to describe intellect, and what a beautiful way to show the signs of true intellect, as Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam has done, by saying that half of intellect, 50% of intellect, and aql, and this logic and rationality, is showing affection, kindness, and consideration towards people. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
When it comes to the analysis of the life of the Imam, one begins to understand that there were a number of challenges that were posed in his lifetime. What kind of challenges? He went through 5 Abbasid caliphs. Who were they? As-Saffah, Al-Mansur, Al-Hadi, Al-Mahdi, and finally Harun al-Abbasi. And during each and every caliphate of these particular 5 tyrants, the Imam Salamullahi Alayhi adopted a number of strategies and became very much influential within the community and within the Muslim Ummah. One thing that the Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim Salawatullahi wa Salamuhu Alayhi was very much distinguished at the onset was the fact that he wanted to purify the intentions as well as correct some of the moral indecencies that were prevalent within the society at that time. In which way? Imam alayhi salam would walk past a house in which music is being played. A servant outside is bringing the rubbish or the garbage. He asks her, the owner of the house that the music inside is being played, is he a slave or is he a master? She responds back by saying, indeed, he is a master. Imam alayhi salam would say to her, if he was a slave, he would have respected his master. And he moves on. The lady goes back. The man inside by the name of Bishr says to her, who did you speak to? She describes this man that she saw. She says he has thafanat. Thafanat means excess skin on his forehead. She says to him that he was so skinny when he was standing, I could see the wind somewhat moving his body and his aba. He immediately recognizes that this is a noble individual, a virtuous man. Tell me, what is it that he said? She responds back by saying that he said, if the man inside the house was a slave, he would have respected his master. That statement hit hard in the heart of this man, Bishr, who runs barefooted to catch Imam Musa ibn Ja'far and says to him, Sayyidi wa Mawlai, halli min tawba.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. And
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
The European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders, by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests. Gas supplies to Europe have tightened and fuel costs have soared since Russia's conflict with Ukraine in February and subsequent sanctions, leaving countries scrambling to refill storage and diversify supply channels. But despite the heavy costs incurred by their citizens, the Russophobia sentiment by many EU countries, especially those with close ties with the US, continues unabated. The Netherlands, Germany, Poland, and Italy are just some of the European countries who are buyers of Russian oil. But now the EU seems to have imposed sanctions on Moscow without having a plan for life without cheap Russian energy. A clear example of sanctions backfiring would be Germany, which recently reported its first trade deficit in 30 years. While the sanctions on Russia were meant to pressure Moscow in light of its special operation in Ukraine, the backfiring of the EU measures have given birth to disagreements between politicians in the bloc. The Hungarian Prime Minister has said that a failure in rolling back the sanctions on Russia risks the destruction of the European economy. Viktor Orban said European leaders should reconsider their strategy, as sanctions have caused widespread damage to the European economy without weakening Russia or bringing the months-long war closer to any resolution.
Absolutely. I think that the Hungarian leader, Viktor Orban, right now is saying what is meant to be unsaid and unspoken, is that basically the sanctions, this pressure campaign from the European Union against Russia because of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine is having a blowback, as the CIA used to put the term, in that the sanctions are actually working against the European economy. And what Orban was addressing was the fuel crisis that exists right now, compounded with the inflation that we see around the world. We're looking at fuel prices increasing, fuel shortages, and issues with fuel supply and logistics to get that fuel to the European market and to many of the nations. Remember that Hungary is landlocked, so it imports most of its oil via pipeline. And so right now we are witnessing a pretty catastrophic next few months and what some people are predicting to be a very tough winter for Europe.
In 2021, the EU imported around 155 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia. The bloc's proposed gas replacements by the end of 2022, which included LNG diversification, renewables, heating efficiency, pipeline diversification, biomethane, solar rooftops, and heat pumps, however, only amount to around 102 BCM annually. The European Commission and member states' efforts to diversify away from Russian fossil fuels were also clearly demonstrated in a memorandum of understanding with Egypt and Israel for LNG exports from the East Mediterranean. However, analysts predicted that there could be significant cost implications for Europe as it looks elsewhere for gas supplies. The International Monetary Fund even indicated that escalations to existing sanctions against Russia could cascade into even steeper energy price increases, deteriorating corporate and household sentiment and financial market disruption.
the European leaders don't really care about their people, and they don't really care about peace. They are interested in serving the military-industrial complex. They're interested, as members of the ruling class, in serving the lapdogs, you know, in Washington, in Brussels, in Vienna. And so they don't really care, ultimately, about peace and stability. Ukraine here is like a sacrificial lamb for the European leaders, by which to pump in more weapons. Germany is rearming itself. NATO is going to increase its weapons. And we see, not only in Europe now, but everywhere, sanctions affect the poorest people. They affect the population. They don't as necessarily affect the leaders.
Spiraling inflation has been eating into the salaries of lower-income Europeans, and this has triggered protests and strikes across the continent over the rising cost of living. From railway workers to pilots, people from all walks of life dissatisfied with the situation have in one way or another expressed their concerns. Now, farmers in Spain have also joined the mass European protests seen in Italy, Poland, and the Netherlands. The farmers' protests seen in Spain, Poland, and Italy come after strikes in the Netherlands have led to many supermarkets running out of food as the anti-government movement continues. The rising cost of fuel has also been a contributing factor to the protests.
U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid have reiterated their anti-Iran positions in a joint declaration. The two leaders signed this statement after holding a one-on-one meeting on Thursday morning in occupied territories, on the second day of Biden's four-day tour of West Asia. The statement says that the U.S. will use all elements of national power available to it to deny Iran the ability to arm itself with nuclear weapons. The joint declaration also includes a pledge by Washington to continue U.S. military aid to Israel. Hours after the announcement of the declaration, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi warned of harsh and regrettable responses, saying any interventions of foreign powers in the region only results in crises and destabilization, while describing Iran's military power as a security factor. Observers believe that the unconditional support of the U.S. for Israel as the only regime that openly threatens Iran with military aggression can further embolden Tel Aviv.
I don't think that Biden's visit to the Middle East has really anything to do about with the arms sale. I think that essentially he's come first and foremost to try to get the Saudis to push up oil production to try to bring down prices at the gas pumps in the United States as Biden moves toward November 5th. Midterm elections for Congress and the Senate, where right now he's expected not to do too well. What I think this stems from is Israel's push to try to get the United States thinking somehow that they're going to intimidate Iran, which is ludicrous. That's not going to happen.
U.S. President's visit to the region comes as Washington and Israel have been pushing for an alliance of regional countries against Iran, the so-called Arab NATO. At the heart of such military alliance lies the perceived threat from Iran. Iranian officials have repeatedly denounced the destabilizing activities of Israel as the main source of insecurity in the region, warning regional countries of the perils of allowing the regime to establish a foothold in the region. Regional states and nations will not achieve stability and peace as long as the fake Israeli regime remains the first stop of U.S. President's trips, with the main target being to preserve the regime's security and dominance. The Islamic Republic of Iran considers the security of its neighbors as its own security. Despite the growing relations between Israel and the Persian Gulf countries amid gradual American withdrawal from the region, several observers consider the emergence of a genuine NATO-style alliance unlikely.
You understand how much more powerful Iran has become in the region precisely because of its alliance with China and Russia. And so if you look at the offshoot of this, is that any threat to Iran also becomes a threat to Russia. Now, Israel, you know, people in Tel Aviv, they understand this. They understand that there's been a shift in the balance of power in the region, and this frightens them. The reaction has been the attempt to build some sort of Middle East NATO, and that's not going to fly. It's not going to fly any more than the talk of European unity. That doesn't exist vis-a-vis Russia. You know, it's just a contrived narrative.
A number of controversial questions are being posed by those analyzing Biden's visit and the so-called Arab NATO. The first question is whether the Arab states need such an alliance. Is the existing joint Arab defense framework so useless that it must be replaced by this new regional NATO? Second, the pact expects to be formed against Iran, but there are differing views on Iran's policies in the region. To include Israel, an occupier of Arab lands, in a new framework against Iran would only exacerbate the regional crises. In fact, a number of Arab officials have openly said in the past few days that their countries would not be a part of an alliance against Iran. And last but not least, not every country has normalized relations with Israel to form a common pact.
U.S. President Joe Biden touched down in West Asia. Meanwhile, it has emerged that his administration is considering lifting the ban on the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. However, reports say the final decision over the issue is expected to hinge on whether Riyadh makes progress towards ending the war in neighboring Yemen.
This decision, supposedly hinging on whether or not Saudi Arabia makes sufficient political progress towards a negotiated solution with Yemen, as articulated, is in fact absurd. It's completely backwards. Rather than forcing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, what it does instead is, of course, fortifies the lethality of the Saudi military, and it also, as well, gives it increased leverage at the bargaining table.
According to media reports, senior Saudi officials pressed their U.S. counterparts to scrap a policy of selling only defensive arms to the Persian Gulf Kingdom in several meetings in Riyadh and Washington in recent months. In February 2021, Biden said he was ending support for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, a policy that included a ban on the sales of offensive weapons. But it was later revealed that U.S. contractors were still maintaining Saudi warplanes that were bombing Yemen. And the Biden administration approved the sale of air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in November 2021.
Therefore, if the United States actually seeks to end the genocidal war against the people of Yemen, this decision to continue offensive arms sales such as precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is the exact opposite of what it should in fact be doing.
That's why one of Biden's main objectives will be to get Riyadh to increase cooperation with Israel. Although full normalization is not expected, Saudi Arabia could take a step in that direction by allowing Israeli flights in its airspace or by quietly increasing military cooperation to counter Iran. While in Israel, talk of military support for the regime was a priority for Biden. At home, any move to rescind restrictions on offensive weapons is sure to draw opposition in Congress, including from Biden's fellow Democrats and opposition Republicans who have been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If it does not yield to providing Saudi Arabia with more weapons, the kingdom may not have an appetite to reset relations with the U.S. at this point in time. Let's not forget, as a presidential candidate, Biden denounced Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Yet, Biden's approach has softened since the start of Ukraine war, which has prompted the United States and other Western countries to appeal to Saudi Arabia to pump more oil
to offset the loss of Russian supplies.
Well, you know, due to U.S.-sponsored sanctions on some of the world's largest oil producers, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, President Biden is facing a crisis that is largely of his own making and that of the United States. Therefore, he comes to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia essentially as a supplicant with his hand outstretched to plead for increased oil production. President Biden, unfortunately, does not have any vision or plan for the Middle East.
The Saudi regime is considered one of the most despotic regimes in the West Asia region, which routinely violates the rights of dissidents. It has engaged in a brutal war against Yemen, which has killed thousands of people, including countless women and children.
In the limelight.
At least 16 recipients of the European Research Council ERC grants making plans to reject UK offer and move their laboratories abroad, as the United Kingdom remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. We'll now present you an article written by Hannah Devlin. The piece is titled Brexit Row Could Prompt Exodus of Senior Scientists from UK. The United Kingdom is facing an exodus of star scientists, with at least 16 recipients of prestigious European grants making plans to move their laboratories abroad, as the UK remains frozen out of the European Union's flagship science programme. Britain's participation in Horizon Europe has been caught in crosshairs of the dispute over Brexit in Northern Ireland, meaning that 143 UK-based recipients of European Research Council fellowships recently faced a deadline of either relinquishing their grant or transferring it to an institute in an eligible country. The British government has promised to underwrite the funding, totalling about £250 million, but a growing number of scientists appear likely to reject the offer and instead relocate, along with entire teams of researchers. The European Research Council, ERC, said 16 academics had recently informed it that they intend to move their laboratories abroad or are in negotiations about doing so. These researchers and some others have been given an extension before their grants are terminated. Moritz Treek, a group leader at the Francis Crick Institute in London, who is due to receive €2 million over 5 years from the European Research Council, ERC, to study the malaria pathogen, is among those contemplating a move. Maurice Trigg said, "A major downside of the UK offer was the lack of flexibility about moving the funding internationally." He said, "It personally makes me very angry. The UK Research Institute really put up a wall for scientists to move the funding. It's all nationalist stuff. It's not about science." The Guardian heard from three other senior academics planning to move, who wished to remain anonymous because they were negotiating contracts. One, a biology professor at a top-ranking university, awarded a €2 million grant, said the impasse over Britain's participation in European Union programmes had already been hugely disruptive. She said, "I feel heartbroken to be put into this position." She added, "Either I leave at huge personal and professional cost, or I stay and miss out on career-changing opportunities. This was supposed to be a massive achievement and recognition of our standing as scientists. Instead, I feel hugely stressed. Another said the offer to match the €2 million funding she had been awarded to research the roots of populism in the 21st century would not replace the prestige of European Research Council grants, widely viewed as the Champions League of academic fellowships. She said, European Research Council, ERC, is a label that is internationally recognized as excellence. For me, as a Latin American immigrant, it's really something that changes my career in Europe. I worked on this proposal for 2 years, and I didn't want to give up something that I really struggled to get. A third senior scientist who plans to transfer a €2 million ERC grant to study the response of animals to climate change to an institute outside of Britain said, "My main motivator for choosing to move is that I lack trust in UK governmental institutions and processes after what I've witnessed since moving here. The loss of these academics is a blow to the British government's proposed bold global alternative to Horizon." Recently, the Science Minister, George Freeman, called on the European Union not to weaponize science for politics before a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, but said the United Kingdom was ready to press ahead with its Plan B if the dispute is not resolved. Others who are remaining in the United Kingdom said they had been left in limbo, with little clarity on when the UK Research Institute funding will be available. Professor Ben Sheldon, an ecologist at the University of Oxford, who was awarded a €3.1 million grant to study the effect of human-caused climate change in the timing of seasonal events in Oxford's Witham Woods, said, "We've heard nothing at all, which is one of the disturbing things. It's like a black hole." Professor Ben Sheldon said the uncertainty about funding meant he could not start recruiting the 4 PhD students, 4 postdoctoral graduates and technicians needed for the project, and since the research focused on seasonal phenomena, this could delay the work by up to a year. He said, "These are major research programs. You can't just recruit people to start the next day," adding, "It's hugely destabilizing." A spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "Successful awardees do not need to leave the United Kingdom to receive funding," adding, "We recognize the European Union's delays to formalizing the UK's association to Horizon Europe have led to uncertainty for researchers, for businesses and innovators based in the United Kingdom." The spokesperson for the Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy said, "This is why the government has guaranteed funding for eligible successful applicants to Horizon Europe, who are expected to sign grant agreements by December of 2022, and who have been unable to sign grant agreements with the European Union. This includes European Research Council winners, claiming the guarantee means that eligible successful applicants will receive the full value of their funding at their UK host institution for the lifetime of their grant. Moreover, it has emerged that British universities are facing a brain drain as a row over Brexit in Northern Ireland threatens £250 million in research funding from the European Union. The European Research Council, ERC, has written to 98 scientists and academics who were recently approved for €172 million in grants, telling them that if the UK's associate membership of the €80 billion Horizon Europe programme is not ratified, they will not be eligible to draw down the money. Scientists have said they're now scrambling to find alternative EU institutions to host the funding, and some already turning down the European Research Council money and hoping the British government's promise of replacement cash will be delivered. But they say in either case it is devastating, as the European Research Council is considered one of the most prestigious programs in the world. The then Brexit Secretary David Frost fought hard to get associate membership of Horizon Europe as part of the trade deal negotiations in 2020, but ratification has been delayed while Britain fails to implement the Northern Ireland Protocol. British scientists say they are being punished. Payam Gamage, a scientist at the Beatson Institute at Glasgow University, said, "It's a strange choice for the European Union. The United Kingdom isn't going to notice it immediately. It will take a long time to have any impact. All that happens is a bunch of scientists have a lot of opportunities taken away or their lives just made a lot more difficult. We're the only victims." Gamage was awarded a 2 million euro award to expand research on mitochondrial genetics and mutations in tumours, but has decided to turn down the European Research Council grant and apply for replacement funding from the UK Research and Innovation Fund. He said this was not the same, as there was no detail about the terms and conditions of funding. Gamet said the idea that Britain could replicate the system and apparatus of something like the European Research Council in the near to medium term is, at best, unrealistic. Seymour Fetzer, a professor of economics at Warwick University, who was approved for €1.5 million funding, said, "We all had reason to believe that the UK Association was just a matter of the UK implementing the free trade agreement. Now we're waking up to the reality. It is very devastating." A molecular biologist who was awarded a €2 million fund for a 5-year research programme said she would now be looking to commute to Ireland or to Belgium. She said, "My main priority is getting the funding, because an award at this level of funding happens once in a lifetime." Starter grants are worth €1.5 million each, and consolidator grants are worth up to €2 million each, with a further round of advanced grants due to the awarded next month, worth up to €2.5 million each, which could take the overall UK funding to about €300 million. Britain's Science Minister George Freeman has pledged to extend the guaranteed replacement funding until December of 2022. The President of the European Research Council, Professor Maria Leptin, said she was fervently hoping that the UK-EU negotiations would be finalised and result in association with Horizon Europe. She said, "Our letters to grantees had to point out the option for portability of the grant outside of the United Kingdom, but nobody here has any wish at all to entice anyone to leave the UK."
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.